Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, welcome to this very special episode of the Curs on Film podcast. This week we will be doing a roundup of the best films we've seen at this year's London Film Festival. I'm Sam Howlett and I'm joined by Jake Cunningham.
Hello.
So this is the 2017 London Film Festival, and for about 10 days...
Yeah, 10 days.
We've been putting ourselves through absolute torture watching some of the world's finest new films. Before anyone else gets a chance to, so we're very lucky to have been given this opportunity.
Yeah, and if you haven't actually, if you haven't been to the festival and you haven't seen the things we're going to be talking about, we're only going to briefly review them anyway, so yeah. There's no spoilers and stuff. But as a prequel to this episode, if you haven't listened to it, you might want to go back and listen to the episode that we did with Kate Taylor as well,
yeah.
The programmer for the festival, to give you an idea about how the films are selected, the journey from kind of the first festivals like Sundance in January, and how the films kind of end up getting here before we get to see them.
Yeah, and that'll make a very nice double bill.
Mm.
So I think quite a few of the films we're going to be talking about today, we'll also be devoting an entire show to further down the line. So we'll just be doing brief little reviews of some of our favourites this year. But should we start with the big one, get that out of the way, what's kind of, I think, probably the most popular film at the festival,
yeah.
The kind of the, one of the big sort of popular talking points,
yeah.
Which is Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water.
Mm. To give you a peek behind the curtain of the press screenings, we kind of, generally most of them happen in one location where the biggest screen is about 600 seats. But The Shape of Water, the press screening was open to Odeon Leicester Square, where you're looking at over 1,500 available yeah. seats. And so there was like two or three press films that were open to Leicester Square, Shape of Water being one of them. So it just shows you how high the demand was.
Yeah, to get into that. Mm. And it's his first film since Crimson Peak. And what's really great about Del Toro's career at the moment is that it seems like he's finally doing what he wants to do solely. He doesn't have to, because as much as I think he loves things like Hellboy and like Pacific Rim, you do get a bit of a feeling that they are to serve a purpose further down.
Yeah.
Do you think that's
and,
fair?
Well, and you look at both of those products are now going ahead without him.
Yeah.
So it's, I think in his other films, the fact it is him, Del Toro, is completely essential to the creation of those stories.
Yeah.
But evidently with Hellboy, Rise of the Blood Queen and Pacific Rim Uprising,
mm-hmm.
previously Maelstrom, much better.
Yeah.
They're going ahead without him.
Yeah. So Shape of Water is set in 1962, and it sees Sally Hawkins as a mute cleaning lady at a top secret government research lab where a monster has been brought in for experiments. The monster is very similar to sort of the creature from the Black Lagoon, or if you've seen Hellboy, there's a character in that called Abe Sapien who has a very similar design.
Yeah, even down to the big facility that they're in, there are elements that this could be a Hellboy prequel.
Yeah.
And I know Del Toro had to come out and say, this is not a secret Hellboy prequel, this is just my Black Lagoon. And he's in the credits, he's just called Amphibian Man.
And she kind of sparks up a sort of interesting relationship with this creature. And I think ultimately the film is a romantic film. which you wouldn't expect. And it's a very adult romantic film.
Yeah, he's kind of gone the whole way with his journey of doing a monster film with a hint of romance. Mm. In the like Pan's Labyrinth, you've got the maid and the soldier, which is a really nice subplot in there. And then Crimson Peak, there was the kind of memes of, it's not a horror film, it's a gothic romance. Crimson Peak is a horror film. I don't have to say it is scary. And then now this is a romance film that has horror elements.
And you've also got, what's really great about this film is that there's so much else going on as well. So you have Richard Jenkins, who
he's
I think
brilliant.
Is ever watchable. And seems to only, the past few years, people really appreciate him. Mm. He's really good as he's her neighbour with his own kind of...
He's got a really sad story. I think he's got one of the best scenes in the film involving someone that he has a crush on.
Yeah.
And it's just terribly sad. And he's kind of this... He's the hopeless romantic that I think Del Toro is.
Really. And he narrates the film as well.
Yeah.
Nice narration. And then Octavia Spencer is Sally Hawkins' friend at work. You've also got Michael Stuhlbarg as a scientist at the laboratory with his own secrets. And then in the villain role is Michael Shannon, the Shan Man.
Because Sam, aren't the real monsters the humans?
Indeed. Indeed they are. And I think at first you could kind of think that Michael Shannon's just kind of coasting along here. He's just playing Michael Shannon. But he really goes for this one as a villain. He's a proper villain.
Yeah, he's very kind of spitty and pussy and greasy.
Literally pussy in one scene. I really liked Michael Shannon in this film because he just gave it his all. Mm. He was a full-on villain. And this film, I think, is so just enjoyable.
Yeah, it's really fun, which I think is more like ignoring Pacific Rim, which obviously is just an out-and-out blockbuster, out of his very personal projects. This is the most fun, this is the most enjoyable. I think he's really romanticising cinema itself. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of a love letter to sweeping romances, but also you've got the Cold War feel to it. And he's really
sci-fi and horror and
B-movie feel, which obviously. But there's a particular moment where the amphibian man sees a cinema screen, and this film made me think of Roger Ebert described cinema as a machine for empathy, and I think that can be argued that that's in every film, but I think here when you're he's actually putting the cinema screen in front of the alien creature who we don't recognise, who we can't understand what he's saying, but instantly we are empathetic with this otherworldly thing. And I think that's what he's going for in all of his films, really. It's like humanising and connecting with the outer people.
So there we go, that's Shape of Water. I'm not sure the UK release date for that.
I think it's going to be February, so it's a bit of a wait. Yeah.
By the way, okay.
Yeah, but before we move on to other films, we have a few other Curzon staff will be dropping in to give their opinions, so not just our boring voices, because you've probably had enough of us. So we'll be bringing in a few other Curzon employees to come and chat about their favourites too, so make sure you stick around for that.
Okay. I'm going to talk a bit about a film called Darling.
Right. Okay.
Which, because at the festival you're given the sort of schedule of the press screenings and you pick out a few favourites, but there are gaps in your schedule and you think, okay, I've got 2 hours to kill there. So, take a chance. And I took a chance in this film called Darling, which I knew nothing about, apart from that it was to do with ballet. And I remembered that on our previous LFF podcast a few weeks ago, Kate Taylor recommended Darling. So I thought I'd check it out, and what a recommendation it was. This is a really, really beautiful film. I think the best way to describe it would be Black Swan, but without the kind of over-the-top melodrama and without any of the weird body horror.
Right.
It's about a ballerina in Denmark, I believe, who has an injury on her hip, which means she has to give up ballet. And her partner is the lead choreographer of this huge production. She has to step down. and then someone else replaces her, and she kind of struggles with that for a while, and eventually she thinks, okay, the way I can do it is I can come in and help help choreograph and help teach this girl who I should be. And there's lots of stuff about jealousy and like about physicality, but it's grounded. It feels real. There's, like I said, there's no over-the-top melodrama that you might expect from this kind of film. It has a Skarsgård in it, but a lesser-known
Skarsgård. Doesn't matter which one. Just as long as your film's got a Skarsgård, we'll be there.
Yeah, so that's Darling. Do check that out when it is released.
Okay, yeah. We might as well go on our chance screenings. Mm. So I'd like to pick one out, which will probably end up in my favourites of the festival, to be honest. And that's Winter Brothers. And this is a Danish film written and directed by Hilmir Palmerson. And I didn't know a lot about it going in. If you see a promo image, it's got this chap with a hard hat and a kind of piece of fabric tied around his nose and mouth. And it looks like that promotional image from Son of Saul. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so I just knew it was Danish miners and not much more beyond that. And it was called Winter Brothers. So went into it. And this is amazing. It's really very darkly funny. It's about this chap who's stealing chemicals from the mine that he works in, using it to make moonshine at home, and then bringing the moonshine back into the mine and selling it to the other miners. And then one of the other miners ends up in hospital. And so the other miners and his brother kind of turn against him a bit and just stop buying his moonshine. And so that's really about it in terms of plot. It's an hour 40 minutes. It's really beautifully shot. It's not just that one still image that extends over to the Son of Saul look. It's got that kind of ghostly floating look to it, a lot of just kind of looking behind people's backs and following their actions, and it starts in the mine. And something that I've noticed about maybe films set in mines, you can see the mine. The mine is underground. You shouldn't be able to see the mine. And this film is actually like, you can't see it. You're like, they have head torches and that is how they light it, which makes sense. And so you kind of spend these first 5 minutes of the film in the dark, just by these headlights. He's like, what is this about? And then it cuts outside and it is bright white snow. And it's just, the whole thing looks amazing. It's shot on film. It's all got this really brilliant grain to it. I would just go and check it out for the visuals alone, but it is really, really funny. It's really awkward. It's got elements of a kind of darker Thomas Vinterberg Peep Show. It's really okay. Cool. Definitely check out Winter Brothers.
All right. Okay, we're now joined by Kate Garova, who's going to tell us some of her highlights of LFF 2017. Hi, Kate.
Good morning. Yes, I'm now speaking at near the end of the London Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And so I'm tired. That's what I'm going to say. But I think the film festival arguably does something, and that is it launches very fresh and distinctive voices and new talent. So there's sort of three films that mm-hmm. I've picked out that I think do that. The first one's out next week, I Am Not okay. a Witch. You're probably yep. going to be talking about that anyway at some point, but I'll have...
Next episode, maybe. But
okay.
Tell us your thoughts.
I'm Not a Witch is an unusual African film. Okay. It's about a 9-year-old girl who is accused of witchcraft, and sort of it's just her story, really. Yeah. And it's imbued with a certain sense of sort of Zambian humour, which I had never encountered before.
No.
I think it is just, it's really distinctive. It's a very unusual story. It's shot really well. You do feel that you are in different filmic territory to the yeah. one that you would normally be in.
Okay.
And it's a great performance from the girl and very startling. So definitely worth watching.
Yeah.
And then I also love Jeune Femme. Mm-hmm. This is about a 30-year-old woman, 29, 30 or 31. We're not quite sure of her age. And when we meet her, she is trying to talk to her ex-boyfriend who has kicked her out. And she does this by banging on his door and then eventually head-banging on his door until she's knocked unconscious and an ambulance has to arrive. And then she has to have medical help. And it's clear that she is, well, some people might call it unhinged, but I think she's just pure angry. And she is startling in the sense that she's this woman, this girl that we don't, again, usually see on screen. Yeah. So it's really quite an unusual performance. It feels very Nouvelle Vague. So it's a very, I'm overusing the word, but fresh again, performance. And it's really about her journey back to sanity in a way and how she does that. But it's just full of like this, it's full of warmth. Yeah. So it's shot in a way that's non-judgmental about her character or some of the decisions that she makes, whether they're good or they're bad. Yeah. She's just doing the best that she can. And it's, I think that there will be a lot of people who have a sense of identity with it because, you know, often you're just lost and you don't know what is the right decision to make. So that's great. So that's Jeune Femme. And then the final film, and I saw this at a different festival, and I was really happy to see it playing here, and it is going to be on release. New Wave are releasing it, so that will mean it will be a quite limited release. But it's a film called Western. And Western is about this a German sort of mining company, and a group of Germans go to a very small Bulgarian town to help. To put in a sort of water plant, and it's the difference between them coming here to this incredibly rural, some might say slightly backward environment, and in particular the sort of the plant manager, he really tries to become part of the local community, whereas all his sort of fellow countrymen and the Germans don't integrate at all and they sit very apart. And so it's about his sort of kind of friendship, some of the friendships that he forms in this sort of small town. And it says a lot about, I guess it says a lot about masculinity. But it also says a lot about culture. It's a really quietly thought out, provoking film that, like I said, I saw at a previous festival and has absolutely stayed with me for some of the performances.
Yeah, great. Kate Grover, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're now joined by Irena Musumeci. Hello.
Hi.
Okay, what was your highlight this year from LFF?
There is one film that I absolutely loved over everything else that I've seen at the festival, and it's a film that I've been waiting for, and it's a film called 120 BPM Beats Per Minute, which is directed by Robin Campillo, a French filmmaker who directed Eastern Boys, very, very interesting drama, which was out a couple of years ago. Robin started as a script writer and became a director. He wrote The Class, the Laurent Cantet film. And I think this is a film that exudes passion for the subject and really kind of a real engagement with its topic. Its topic is it's the lives of a group of young AIDS activists who were part of ACT UP, which was one of the first big AIDS charities in the late 80s, early 90s. ACT UP kind of came to the fore because they were very, they used very shocking techniques to kind of really shake people from what they perceived was the absolute indifference of the world towards AIDS-related death. Full disclosure, around about that time, I was equally shocked and interested in what ACT UP were doing, and it really grabbed my my attention. I was a massive Queen fan, and when Freddie Mercury died, it was probably the first time I'd ever heard about AIDS or anything related to that. I grew up in Catholic Italy. So it was something that I felt very, very passionate about, and so I became an activist myself. I wasn't part of ACT UP, but I did do a few things in Italy with local groups. So I really recognized a lot of the energies and what was going on in the film, the dynamics of the discussion between the activists and how they negotiate, how they're going to represent their cause and what they are going to do and what length they're prepared to go to fight it. But the, at the core of it is a story about people who are fighting for the right to live and the right to love who they love. And so it's a film that just has empathy all over it. And is not just simply a kind of compassionate, tragic story, ooh, everyone's going to die. Yeah. Because it's a film that really has the power to defy death, I think. Right. Really, it's got an energy, you know, coming from its title, it really runs at 120 beats per minute. It's got some amazing, amazing scenes that celebrate life in all its glory. Dancing, partying, being with friends, joining a cause, making sure that illness doesn't mean that your life stops.
Yeah.
And therefore, it also celebrates sexuality in a very overt and in a very, very important way. There's a scene in it that really I think is probably the most important scene I've seen in a film mm-hmm. this year, which is a sex scene between two people, one of whom is ill and the other one isn't. And that was something that, as a discourse in terms of AIDS activism and HIV activism, right. is so important, that you can continue to have a sexuality if you protect yourself, if you look after yourself and you look after others. But it doesn't mean, you know, it kind of defies the stigma. Yeah. And so it's fantastic that it's represented in that way and really so celebrated. There is just so much about this film that is very erotic and really sexy and just absolutely brilliant. There's also, so I don't want to give away the ending, but there was a point in the film where I thought, okay, the story's over, this is it, yeah. it's finished. And the following 10 minutes absolutely devastated me physically. I was sobbing, I was a mess, I could not mm-hmm. talk. And it's precisely, you know, it wasn't one of these things, oh, this is so sad that people yeah. are dying, because people are dying yeah. in the film, but it's what comes after that was okay. represented in such a cathartic way and in such a powerful and recognizable way. And it really did something to me, this sequence. Yeah. And I just think it was, yeah, a complete catharsis. So it's a film that leaves you energized, that will want to make people embrace a cause, particularly if they know people who are affected still today by AIDS and HIV. And it's just a great celebration of believing in the power of saying something, doing something, and really.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Defying silence and death. So it's terrific, and I don't think I'm even doing it justice by heaping all this hyperbole on it, because you don't want to like raise expectations and then people expect something different. But it's a very, very visceral film as an experience. Right. I think it's just absolutely wonderful.
Awesome. Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're now joined by Elliot, who's going to tell us about The Killing of a Sacred Deer. Elliot, what did you like about it so much?
It's probably one of the funniest films I've seen in a long time.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes me sound like a complete maniac, but yes, the way the dialogue was delivered versus what's happening on screen is probably one of my favourite juxtapositions of, you know, it just made me laugh a lot.
Right, okay.
There were a couple of moments in the film especially where I felt like they kind of broke character,
which
I really enjoyed. There was a particular scene where Colin Farrell's character just breaks down, and it's the first real emotional kind of point in the film, and probably the only emotional point in the film I can think of, which made it that much more impactful for me. So,
okay. Have you seen Lanthimos's other stuff? Before this,
I've seen The Lobster,
Okay.
which I found very funny, but it was definitely in you know, it was more humorous in the idea that the idea of it was so silly.
Right. Okay.
It's, you know, what's your favorite animal? You're going to turn into your favorite animal. I heard someone describe his films as being a pub question turned into a film.
Okay.
Which I thought was quite funny. So, what's your favorite animal? Okay, we'll make a film based around this concept. And this one is so. If you had to kill a member of your family, who would it
right.
be? But yes.
Okay, so it's like the humor coming from, because I found it quite alienating for the audience.
Yeah, I suppose because of how auto-cued everyone
is,
it means that maybe the tension isn't wrapped up quite as high.
Yeah.
I mean, you can imagine a different director doing something very different
with that
story. But because of that, I felt like it just conceptually kind of drove me to be much more engaged with it. But again, I definitely saw it as more of a kind of farcical, humorous ride more than anything.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of people are kind of talking about how disturbing it is, how freaky it is. And
yeah, definitely. And it is. It is definitely, you know, it's a very dark film. It asks a lot of horrible questions.
Yeah.
The decisions that both Doug Emin and Colin Farrell's characters make or choose not to make
are
particularly galling, especially as a parent, just going like, so you're not going to put yourself forward in any of this? No. And that is actually kind of written off from the very beginning.
Right.
They have a conversation about what decisions they're not going to make.
Yeah.
Which again, I really enjoyed because it added to the conceptual humour of it.
Yeah. For me. I think as well there's something about seeing these A-list celebrities like Colin Farrell and Nicole Kidman acting in these scenes and reading that dialogue and doing those things that is just so weird. And
Yes, and general anaesthetic is never going to sound the same to me ever again.
Great, Elliot, thank you very much.
No
cheers.
Thank you.
I'd like to talk a bit about Thoroughbreds, which... So at the time of recording, we don't know what's won best film.
No.
But that's in the competition category. And this is a film based on the play by Corey Finley, who is adapting it and writing and directing this one. It stars Anya Taylor-Joy, who you'd recognise from The Witch and Split, and then Olivia Cooke, who you'd know from Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. And they play these kind of bored, upper-middle-class... sort of teenagers about to head off to college, and then Olivia Cooke's character has a kind of, there are rumours circulating about what she has done to a horse, and the film kind of transpires from there. It's this kind of dark, pitch black, at times comedy, about, and it's very similar to things like Heathers or Cruel Intentions. And it's also, most of it's set in this huge mansion, and the way it's, I think stylistically it's kind of similar to Stoker, where you've got loads of like close-ups and loads of like, the sound is like really in your ear, like there's a scene of someone like sharpening a pencil that just feels like they're doing it right next to your head. So really impressive that he's turned a play into something so visual, so cinematic. So
I read like this is American Psycho meets Heathers.
I think that's a fair assessment. Yeah, I mean, it's dark. It's black comedy. It's also Anton Yelchin's final film as well.
Okay.
So, and he's very good in it he's got a kind of twisted character. But yeah, so I think for that reason alone, it's worth watching.
Yeah, I think it's nice to focus on these films that are in competition or the first feature, because there are big films that are playing the festival, like The Shape of Water that we mentioned. But other films like Call Me By Your Name and The Party, I mean, is already out. Call Me By Your Name has been around since Sundance and it's been given so much coverage already.
Yeah.
And we look forward to giving that a full episode. But I think the great thing about the festival is it's a chance for us to profile films that maybe don't get a release or won't be around for a couple of months or even this time next year.
Yeah.
So in that respect, I think it would be a good time to bring Columbus.
Yeah. So this is a film by YouTube filmmaker.
Yeah, Cognada. He prefers Vimeo.
Okay.
Because you're more likely to have your stuff not taken down. And so he was a video editor by trade, and just made these great video collage video essays on Vimeo. He loves Ozu. He's got this amazing video which is just three separate screens, and it's re-showing different composition from Ozu films and how he kind of reuses this same composition throughout. And thing with what he likes about those Ozu films is like this use of frames within frames within frames. So you're shooting from maybe one side of a kitchen through a kitchen door, and through that kitchen door there might be a mirror, and you're maximizing your space with the minimum amount of impact from the camera. And so people can walk in and out of a scene and have a natural conversation, and the camera doesn't have to bounce around and get shot, reverse shot, yeah, and tracking. You can leave it as it is, so you can really get lost in the space and the conversation. And that is obviously something that has translated into Columbus.
Yeah, and Columbus isn't, considering his background is so kind of visual and experimental, the film is actually very human and very natural, and is just a very simple, you know, kind of, it feels very like sort of American independent Sundance film story of a girl in Columbus, Indiana. Mm. Sort of crossroads in her life, and then she meets John Cho, whose father is a professor who's in a coma in hospital, and he's visiting the town because of his father's condition. And they just kind of meet up with each other by chance and just have conversations about life.
Yeah, and the backdrop is that his father is an architect professor, and Columbus, Indiana is this strange modernist metropolis full of absolutely amazing buildings. The city was kind of just born post-war, and so it's around the 50s that all these structures started getting built. And his dad really loves it. There's a point where she asks him if his dad believes in an afterlife, and he says he believes in modernism. And so you get these conversations, as you say, about life, but you get these backdrop of she's effectively giving John Cho her list of her favourite buildings. So every conversation, it takes place in front of one of these. And they talk about the buildings as well. I think that's actually what's really nice about it, is you could just make this a beautiful setting to have conversations about philosophy and life. But they actually address the buildings, and they talk about the role of the buildings, and you really get swept up in the meaning of architecture and the meaning of a single brick and things like this.
Yeah.
And then there's actually a moment where it's the Indiana City Hall, which has these kind of floating brick structure out the front, and you're almost building up to it the whole time. And then there's just this one shot, and you suddenly kind of, you get it. It's like, I love this building because you've had an hour and a half of them kind of talking about what this means. And I can't wait to turn around and watch it again. It's one of those ones where even as the credits roll, you think, yes, get me back in there.
Yeah, John Cho also showed up in another film called Gemini this year, which is a noir. This is a kind of mumblecore noir, where Zoe Kravitz is a Hollywood actress and Lola Kirk is her assistant, and a crime takes place which leaves, and Lola Kirk sort of sets it on herself to
solve
it. Has
Danny Ocean robbed the Bellagio? Is that the crime?
That's the crime.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
And John Cho is a detective. So the film, you know, wears its genre on its sleeve. It's very much trying to be a kind of Raymond Chandler-esque noir, but for the Instagram era.
Ho-ho, lovely.
That will go on the poster.
Yep, well done, mate. Right, so what else have we seen? Fantastic Woman.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that will be out fairly soon.
Yeah.
But that was a great one where it was a coincidence of time and place, and we could just get in. And that's really great, because you don't have time. It's like, oh, I don't want to... You know, you spend so much time fawning over the program and planning. Yeah. So when you actually just go, oh, can I get into something? What can I get into? Quickly, we'll get in there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, God, that was a real treat, wasn't it?
That's really, yeah. That's an astounding film. Because if you listen to our Berlin Festival roundup, Kate and Damon talked about Fantastic Woman. And so it has been in my mind for such a long time now. And it really does live up to the expectations.
I think we're going to talk to Kate in a bit, So it'd be nice to see if kind she, of yeah. like 9 months later after Berlin that Fantastic yeah. Woman is finally kind of getting an English audience, and I imagine that must be quite exciting. It's so cool to like, this is what's great about the festival circuit, is you get this, you follow something.
Yeah.
And that was me with Columbus.
Right.
That seeing that Coganada, whose videos I love, has this film at Sundance, and you're so willing to love it. And you think, oh yeah, Sundance loved it. All right, Berlin. Then it's like, it's tracking, it's like, people still really like it. And then you get, you start to worry about yourself. And it's like, oh no, what if I don't love it? No, what am I going to do? And that, yeah, it's almost like a sport in a strange little way, isn't it?
It is.
And you develop these fandoms.
Yeah.
But yeah, Fantastic Woman, that's about a trans woman in Chile whose partner dies. And she kind of goes on this process of grieving, but she can't really do that. She's just such a victim of physical and mental violence because her partner was an older man, and you've got his family who never quite accepted her, and it was like a surprise death as well, and so there were stuff like planned holidays, apartments,
cars, dogs, just admin.
Yeah. And it is like, and that's actually something that doesn't really get brought up in films about like a family death, is that there's so much boring stuff to do.
Yeah. But while you have to grieve and mourn and change your entire life. Yeah.
But as someone who is having to live in a violent situation already,
yeah,
who, like, particularly in South America, violence against trans women is very high, and so to have to go through all of that you do on a daily basis already whilst grieving the person you love, and still having to effectively live through moments of their life because you're having to go through their stuff, you're having to meet their family who have never respected you or liked you, and yet he is never blamed. Like the partner.
No.
Like, that's it. It's everything is her fault.
Yeah.
And she's ruined everything. But it's what I think is great is the title of the film, because that fantastic has a kind of vibrance to it.
Yeah.
And there are a few moments in the film where it just, you just kind of see where she's a singer and it kind of loses itself into these hallucinatory dream moments. Mm. Where suddenly there's a really sad club scene when she's just trying to kind of feel something, I suppose. And then it transcends into this amazing cheerleading sequence where she's kind of flying in the air.
Yeah.
And these little moments kind of keep you going and just lift you from the mire of it for a bit. But really cool. And the screenwriter came out afterwards and told us about the story, and that the actress Danielle Vega was originally just... she is a trans woman, and she was originally just a research. Like, they just spoke to her about her life.
Yeah.
And then it's like, right, who do we find as an actress then? Oh, we'll just get the person that we already know.
All right. So my last recommendation then that I saw this year would be Sweet Country. This is a Australian Western. So set in the 1920s, North Australia. I think it's North Australia. And it's very similar to what we think was like the Wild West of America. And the Aboriginals are enslaved by the sort of white landowners. And it's about one of the slaves shoots a white man in self-defense and then goes on the run.
Right.
And it's very naturalistic. It's kind of quite a low-key Western. But kind of in a similar way to The Shape of Water... The director, Warwick Thornton, gives a lot of different characters a character. They're not just good guy, bad guy. You know, they're kind of...
Except Sam Neill.
Sam Neill's a very good guy.
It's Sam Neill.
But he's also, because I have interviewed the director and we'll be playing that interview when we review the film properly. He talked about how, like, Sam Neill's character is not that he's good, he's naive.
Right,
because he's a holy man, and he thinks, oh, we're all equal in the eyes of God, and all this, and he's thinks God will just save everyone. So it's not necessarily that he's good; it's just sort of a naive innocence to him.
Mm.
But the editing of this film is incredible, where it will, while a character is in a scene, it will there'll be a jump cut to a moment in the character's past or the character's future. Just a quick shot. Just to kind of suddenly give you that feeling that this is a whole person.
Yeah.
That this is not just a person who's evil in this scene or good in this scene, that they have a past and a future that makes them this character now.
That's really neat.
Yeah. Yeah, highly recommend it. If you like Westerns, I think you'll love this. But it's also really great to see this part of the world and this time, this history on screen, because I really don't think I've seen it much before. So that's Sweet Country.
Okay. Right, I'll just talk about the most recent film that I've seen, which is Claire Denis' Let the Sunshine In. And so Let the Sunshine In has got Juliette Binoche as a middle-aged artist, successful artist, I think, in Paris. And she is kind of in a... It's maybe a midlife crisis. She's not going out and buying Ferraris. It's more of a love life crisis. And the film doesn't get swept up into a romantic comedy plot of, oh, here's a bad guy, like here's the John Hamm from Bridesmaids, and then we introduce the Chris O'Dowd, but then she's not sure. It's not that. It's a string of just not kind of physically harmful relationships, but just not great. And it's that kind of thing that maybe, I don't know, we wouldn't know, but like once you reach a point in life, you're not maybe looking for kind of adventure and romance and excitement all the time. There's that element of you're looking at wanting security and just someone to be there,
to be content with.
And none of these men are that. And it's just that is the film. It's just her going from one person to the next person. It's really sad. Well, I don't know. People have kind of had different reactions to it, and it's a film that I've really, at the time I was into it, but I wasn't kind of fully in love with it. But out of most of the films that we've watched, this is one that's really lingered with me actually. And I even thinking about it before, keeping me up a bit. Just thinking, this is a really, really sad film. And the thing that makes it sad is that she is not that sad.
Okay.
Like, she's actually really hopeful. Someone on Twitter said that she has so much feeling in her eyes. And that's it. Like, she's got these clashing emotions of, I could have sex with this man, which is something that I want, but he doesn't provide any financial security, which is also maybe something that I want, or he doesn't have the friendships that I want, or he's not, someone brings up, this man is not in the same milieu as you. And she's got all these conflicting ideas about what she should have out of a romantic relationship, and it feels like it's just kind of bursting out of Binoche's face all the time. And I think that person put it really well, that she has so much feeling. And at the beginning of each one, she is just so hopeful. She's got a little bit of excitement there, but you can see that it's tinged with, I've been here so many times before already. And you just worry that this film is like, although it maybe ends on a point that is a bit hopeful because we've seen it so many times in the film before, you just know that this is just part of the turning of the wheel. And it's another circle of this relationship that she goes on. It's really sad, and it's really beautifully shot as well. And Binoche is excellent. And yeah, I really recommend Let the Sunshine In.
Okay, so that was it. That's our LFF roundup. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week to discuss...
Yeah. I think we've got I Am Not a Witch, which actually played the festival as well. So excited to bring that. And it looks like we're going to be able to bring you a Q&A from the premiere at Curzon Soho as well.
Excellent.
So really excited to bring that out.
Cool. So thank you very much for listening. It's goodbye from Jake.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.